And welcome back to Coast, where this hour, it's the interactive portion of the show. We'll take your phone calls with Laird Scranton as we talk about Worlds in Collision, Velikovsky's work, and also Laird's work decoding the Maori cosmology. That's kind of neat, the ancient origins of New Zealand's indigenous culture. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Laird Scranton with us. We'll get to your calls as well as we talk about Velikovsky, Worlds in Collision, and Laird's book called Decoding the Maori Cosmology. Where do we get this book, Laird?
This book you can get pretty much anywhere. It's on, of course, it's available on Amazon and in bookstores. You may find it on the shelf at Barnes & Noble. It's available at my publisher's website, innertraditions.com, or at simonandschuster.com. It can be ordered through any bookstore.
You enjoy this subject matter, don't you?
Oh, I do. I mean, it sucks me right in. I mean, I really... had a toehold with the Dogon back in the late 1990s, and I haven't surfaced since.
I was fascinated with the Dogon story, too, about the star system, the binary star of Sirius. I mean, how do you really think they knew about it?
I believe them when they say they learned about it from somebody who understood it, that the explanations are so coherent and clear about how... processes of creation happen, how about certain astronomic functions and structures, things that a primitive African tribe should have no way of knowing. We also have confirmation from Buddhism that that was the case. The Buddhists see it the same way. So there's every reason for me to think that somebody back in ancient times knew a lot more than we imagine they did, and it might not have been somebody from here.
Do we know what kind of structure the Maori cosmology crowd had in terms of organization within their tribe?
It's very similar to what the Dogon have. This is organized at a village level with a class of what are referred to as experts in Maori culture. These are the equivalent of the Hogan priests for the Dogon. But the title that is applied to a priest with the Maori can never be applied to really any expert in a subject. The outlook is that if you want to learn about anything, you want to learn it from the guy who knows how to do it. This is partly why the Dogon never adopted a written language, because they felt that written language is a way of representing that you know something without actually having mastered it.
Back to Velikovsky for a moment. You have reported that Jupiter's great red spot is big enough to eject the planet.
Well, the recent measures that was done of it by the Juno probe says it's 1.5 times the diameter of the Earth. We've seen periods of time where it was estimated to be 3 times the diameter of the Earth. It reaches down at least 200 miles into the Jupiter atmosphere. There have been some... reports that it dips down all the way to the core of the planet, and we understand that it also reaches all the way up to the top of the atmosphere. So it could provide us with a kind of an elevator to have ejected that planet-sized body.
All right, let's go to get some calls. Larry in Michigan, welcome to the program. Hey, Larry, thanks for calling.
Hi, I'd like to ask you a question.
Okay.
I saw Venus take off. Did Venus come back to Earth?
What do you mean?
I saw Venus take off. Last year, shoot a light. What was that?
I'm not sure what you're talking about. Venus has a parent motion from the Earth that moves around the sky in a particular pattern, and it's visible for certain number of days of year, and then we can't see it because it's blocked by the glare of the sun and other things for other periods of the time in a year. So. Venus really itself has not changed where it is in recent times. Velikovsky says that it changed its orbit over a period of thousands of years.
What has captured it in its position right now? The sun?
Say that again.
What has captured Venus where it is right now? The sun?
Oh, no. According to Velikovsky, Venus made a close approach to the Earth. And so... the suggestion is that one factor that might have helped circularize its orbit is the drag of its ion tail. It has a cometary tail. The Venus Express probe has found remnants of that tail. Venus actually does have a non-visible comet's tail right now. When Venus makes its closest approach to the Earth, that tail extends out into space millions of miles as far as the Earth, and it points directly at the Earth. So that's one of the factors that might have contributed to circularizing it.
Let's go to Paul in Eugene, Oregon. Welcome to the program, Paul. Go ahead, sir.
How are you guys doing?
Okay, Paul. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you. How are you doing on this fine night?
We're good.
That's good. That's good. That's good. I wanted to talk about your Maori culture.
All right.
Okay.
All right. And what you guys were talking about, I want to relate that to the West here. So let's get on that. First of all, one of their cultural concepts is mana, power, prestige, or authority. What do you guys think about that?
You follow him there, Laird?
So you're saying one of the concepts is mana with an M?
Yep. Your authority.
Okay, in Egypt there's a concept of Maat, and there's also a concept of the feminine as an authority that was Nana, N-A-N-A. I mean, N-A, N-A. I haven't come across a concept of the Maori of Mana that connects the concepts of authority. There is... There's obviously the biblical tradition of manna that fell from heaven, supposedly with the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt. I have not come across that as being a major theme in Maori cosmology.
Any similar Native American tribes that have the same kind of culture as the Maoris?
From my perspective, it's all the same stuff. If you follow the tradition, okay, it looks as if the Maori tradition came out of the Fertile Crescent region. If you follow that same tradition across Siberia and Mongolia, you know, if you follow it eastward, you see a yurt, the structure of a yurt. There's one variety of yurt that is exactly the same form and symbolism as a Navajo roundhouse. There's another variety of yurt called the teepee that is the same form as a Native American teepee. The Native American traditions look like they tie to the same cosmology, but it went through a different path. It went eastward instead of the Maori tradition. For me, went south into India, and then jumped by sea to the United Kingdom, and then to Polynesia.
How difficult was it, Laird, for you to study this and research it?
Well, it's taken 20 years to get a comparative view of it. The thing is that without an understanding of how these various elements are looked at in a lot of different cultures, you don't have a reference to tie the Maori things to. One really big help is language. This was originally an oral tradition, and so syllables were originally symbolic. You know, Ra is the concept of the sun in Egypt. There are, in English, it's the equivalent of two-letter syllables that carry meaning before written language appears. Well, the Maori language is framed on those same syllables. They basically mix and match those syllables together to form words. And so if you know what the syllables mean, you can predict, before you even know anything about a Maori word, what it likely refers to. You substitute concepts for syllables, and the word tells you what it means.
What is the tie-in with Göbekli Tepe and the Maoris? And Göbekli Tepe, of course, being in Turkey.
One really interesting mythical connection is there's a departmental god named Tane in Maori culture who was said to have ascended to the gods and returned with three baskets of knowledge. If you're familiar with the carvings on the pillars at Göbekli Tepe, one of the prominent carvings is of three what look like basket-like structures. The cosmology is referred to by the Dogon as a basket cosmology. And the concept of a basket plays out in other cultures. A basket-like shape created a portable shrine in ancient Egypt in early times. The basket shape combines the shape of a circle, which is the handle on top, with the shape of a square, which is the base of the basket. And this is a metaphor for the non-material and material coming together. The circle is symbolic of the non-material and the square symbolic of the material. So the more we have that symbolism, and they have myths that that you could argue tied back to go back to Tepe. They also have language that connects to eras that came out of, the traditions that came out of the go back to Tepe era. We have connections to Turkish language and connection to the Tamil language, which is a later development. We have artifacts on New Zealand that have been discovered that had Tamil writing on them. One of the confusions was, how could they have artifacts from India that seem to connect to Hinduism, but they don't have any of the Hindu deities? Well, my perspective is, this was pre-Hindu. The cosmology is really a pre-Hindu tradition. And on Orkney, it has, there are direct connections to around 6,000 BC in the Fertile Crescent for like half a dozen different elements on Orkney. You can say that a group migrated from the Fertile Crescent to Orkney before Hinduism appeared.
Let's go to Tom in La Jolla, California. Hey, Thomas, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call, sir. Laird, great research. A comment and a question. You know, Velikovsky really inspired several people who are became coast-to-coast guests, like James McCanney, Walter Thornhill out of Australia, David Talbot,
right.
Who was not a physicist but analyzed Velikovsky's work. And what my question focuses on, one of the last monographs that Velikovsky published was about the psychological trauma of the Venus cometary event, which was relatively recent. We're talking two Venus encounters, I believe 2500 BC and 1600 BC. I believe it was 900 years apart, but that was very recent.
Right.
And Velikovsky hypothesized that the world went into a post-traumatic amnesia. And also, you know, as a psychologist, psychiatrist, hypothesized that we transitioned worldwide from a matriarchal society, peaceful matriarchal society, to a warlike patriarchal society. And because these events were so recent, we're talking 3,000 years ago,
uh-huh.
You know, that the world went into an amnesia, and we forgot about the Venus encounters, the two Venus encounters, and it changed the whole psychology of the world because of these very intense post-traumatic stress response to these cometary encounters, which were catastrophic, to say the least.
Right.
And I was wondering if you would comment, you know, if you know anything about Velikovsky's last theories about the idea that the world went into amnesia about the Venus encounters.
Yes, he wrote a book about the world being in amnesia, looking at things from a psychological point of view, and that was very much his point of view, that those traumatic events essentially caused, on a cultural level, what happens to a person when they develop amnesia. Now, there, as far as the reversals from matriarchy to patriarchy, there are a whole cluster of symbolic reversals that occur midway through the cosmology. You see the effects of them beginning around 3000 BC. The most obvious one is matriarchy being supplanted by patriarchy. But they happen cross-culturally. They happen in the same eras, among cultures that shouldn't have had any contact with each other. So the question is, how could they know to make these reversals if they hadn't had contact with each other? Well, my perspective on that is, I use the metaphor, imagine if you're taking a cross-country flight. You get on a plane in New York City and you fly to California. Now, the chances are when you get on the plane, you might not know anybody else on the plane. You might have, you know, cursory contact with one or two people on the plane, but somehow by the time the plane arrives at its destination, everybody has changed their watch by 3 hours. It's not because they communicated that necessity to each other on the plane. It's because they understand how time zones work. And the cosmology works the same way. There are eras, as the Buddhists define with their yuga cycle eras. There are particular eras to this cycle of cosmology, and certain things are appropriate in certain eras. And so all the cultures that were instructed in this tradition understood what those eras were. When it came to be the right time, they switched their symbolism, they switched their practices. There's also an effect in Buddhism that humanity becomes more progressively more removed from non-material influences, which are ostensibly benign influences. And so over time, things get essentially worse, that our behavior becomes worse as we move further away from these beneficial influences. Now, I'm not sure that Velikovsky had any sense of that or any belief in any of that, but from a cosmological perspective, those things have a lot more influence for me in what's gone on with the transition of humanity. I do agree that it looks as if some very traumatic things happened. Around 700 BC, a major effects happened that we can't explain. There's a major fluctuation in the magnetic field of the Earth they can't explain. It's a period of major volcanic activity. Climate change happens so that crops that had been grown for thousands of years in China no longer could be cultivated there. We have a change in radiometric isotope absorption rates of plants, so that radiometric dating doesn't work across the boundary of 709 BC. We also have a peculiar thing happen, that no total eclipse of the sun that happened prior to 709 BC in any culture has been confirmed to the place and date of its reported occurrence.
Laird, what do you think of those who think that the planet Earth is only 6,000 years old?
I think that there's so much evidence that we can point to that requires it to be far older than that, that I don't think it's really a supportable viewpoint.
We're clearly 4.5 billion years old, aren't we?
Yeah, we certainly are more than four or 6,000 years old.
We're old. Laird Scranton with us. His latest book is called Decoding Maori Cosmology. It's about the New Zealand's indigenous culture as well. How unique are the Maori?
The Maori have lots and lots in common with cultures all on islands all across Polynesia. So I wouldn't call them unique. They also have things in common with the Hopi Indians and with Native tribes in South America. And we can point to lots and lots of commonalities with groups that came out of Neolithic Scotland in the United Kingdom. So they are a unique culture in that they benefited from more isolation than other cultures have had. They were allowed to develop in isolation their own unique tribal culture, but that has an awful lot of overlap with groups like the Dogon.
Okay, we're coming back, Laird, and we'll take some final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Laird Scranton. We'll take your calls as well. We're talking about his work Decoding Maori Cosmology, the Ancient Origins of New Zealand's Indigenous Culture. While New Zealand was doing its thing, what was going on in Australia? Anything, Laird?
Well, Australia it has a much older tradition. The gentleman, Francesco Briganti, who wrote a book called Shakti Cult of Orissa. This is a go-to text about the Shakti cult, the matriarchal cult that came down out of the Fertile Crescent, says that its influence is extended as far south and east as Australia. And we find commonalities with some of the Aboriginal people in Australia to that tradition. So this is thousands and thousands of years before the Maori tradition. We have a mix of things going on in Australia at that time. There are people who feel that the ancient civilization of Mu was centered in the region of Australia. There are references to that sort of thing in the traditions I study, but they're equivocal references. The word Mu means ancestor in a number of the cultures I deal with. So when they talk about Mu in ancient times, they might simply be talking about ancestors, not about a culture. But where the Dogon speak, or no, where the ancient Egyptians speak of a first time, and the Buddhists talk of the first time that knowledge was passed to humanity by a Buddha, the Dogon talk about a time when humanity was restored to culture. And so clearly from the Dogon perspective, they imagine that there were other periods of high culture before the Ice Age.
If you had a chance to talk with Velikovsky, if he were around today, what would you ask him?
That's a very good question. Actually, I had a phone call from Velikovsky's grandson.
Really?
Yes. Sitting at home one July afternoon, and the phone rang. It was a name we didn't recognize. And my wife picked up, and he said, well, Laird won't know who I am, but tell him that it's Velikovsky's grandson. So he had been online searching for possible videos. He had attended some of his grandfather's lectures as a child and was trying to find YouTube videos of those lectures, and turned up my book and ordered a copy and liked it and wanted to call and thank me for having written it.
Didn't,
so that was almost as good as talking with Velikovsky.
Didn't a number of Harvard professors try to boycott the publisher of his book?
Yeah, there were a lot of people who really went out of the way, a lot of nasty things that went on. The head of a planetarium in Washington, D.C. was fired because he scheduled a Velikovsky show, a show based on Velikovsky's theories. And you had forces lined up on both sides of the divide. This was, for 1950, you don't really expect that kind of politicalization, the wide polarization of thought that we're seeing today, but Velikovsky created that in the 1950s, that effect, at least for a period of time.
How did a psychiatrist get involved like Velikovsky did in that field?
I think he had always had an interest in it. He had edited a magazine in the early days in Berlin that Einstein took charge of editing the science and mathematical articles. This was an academic journal. And so they became friendly as a result of cooperating on that academic journal. And I'm sure that's where Velikovsky first got his interest in the kinds of topics that Einstein was working on.
We take text and tweets. Tom, what do you have for us over there?
We have something from Shirley in West Palm Beach. I was wondering if Laird could tell us if there are any symbolic elements to be found at Coral Castle.
Coral Castle. You were that down in Homestead, Florida, where
sure.
Edward Leeds Scullin built his structure very strangely, all by himself.
Yes, my friend Ed Nightingale actually is the guy who has mm-hmm. lead on that. He spent quite a bit of time comparing.
He's been on the show.
Elements of Coral Castle to elements that he's researched on the Giza Plateau in Egypt. There are proportions that are the same, and there are measurements that are the same, and placements that are in parallel to each other, and so forth. He's much more up on the topic than I am. I know that it's a significant place. I know that there are lots of questions about how one guy was able to move multi-ton stones to create the structure. He claimed to have discovered the technique by which ancient cultures were able to move megaliths, and I hardly think there's a better way of proving that than demonstrating it.
He knew the secrets of the pyramids, he said.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Monterey, California. Joseph's with us on the wild card line to get us started here. Hi, Joseph.
Thank you, George, for taking my call.
Sure thing,
sir. You have an excellent guest. He has a lot of courage. He's on the right track. One good question. How do ancient cultures view mental illness as a rite of passage into higher or altered states of being, such as healers, mystics, prophets, and messages? Is there any indication that this is a universal process that non-physical beings use to advance certain people? Some people refer to it as a spiritual emergency.
The archaic philosophy that the traditions I study is based on is called Samkhya. It comes out of India. It's a companion to yoga. And in the view of Samkhya, universes form in pairs, non-material and material, and that the non-material is characterized as having perfect knowledge but an inability to act, and the material is characterized as having imperfect knowledge with full ability to act. And so they say that there are routine attempts made from the non-material side to induce action or to communicate knowledge to the material side, and that those take the form of vivid dreams, the strange behavior of animals, everyday coincidences, divination, psychological, like paranormal effects, like clairvoyance, and that it's really a matter on the material side of paying attention to those and crediting them. The way it is presented is almost as a cosmic game of charades, where tiny effects happen that if you're paying attention, start to make you scratch your head and say, gee, that seems awfully strange that you know, these three things happened in sequence with each other, or that I keep getting the same very odd reference in four different contexts. Eventually, a person stops and thinks about it, and those who credit that something might be going on besides just everyday coincidence tend to foster it to themselves. It's like discovering somebody at a party who went to the same high school you did, or knows somebody, some sure-tail relative of yours in the family that you're drawn to talk to them more when you realize you have something in common. Well, the non-material is more drawn to try to communicate with people who are paying attention.
Next up, let's go to Brian in Evansville, Indiana. Hi, Brian. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, George.
Hey there.
You are the best announcer ever.
Oh, thanks, Brian.
I appreciate it.
Well, I enjoy your voice. You've got a great radio voice, and you do a darn good job.
Thank you so much.
Well, no, thank you. But anyway, I just called to ask a question, and it kind of goes along with what you're talking about.
Okay.
Planet X. Have not heard about it forever. You will never hear about it on a regular news station. Where is it at, and what's going on? You said Venus is slowing down. We're having a lot of catastrophic events around the world. Not just around the country, around the world, we're having the weather and everything is changing, and I don't think it's man-made. I think it has to do with polarity with the other planets.
All right. What do you think, Laird, of Planet X?
There are lots of indications that there's something out there influencing orbits of bodies out there. They haven't been able to pinpoint yet what it is. One of the theories is that there's a large planet out there that we haven't accounted for yet. There's some other theories that say that, oh, no, they can account for it without the planets. I'm not enough of an expert on the astronomy to be able to reconcile, you know, those points of view. I think it's quite possible. This falls in category for me of an open question. Through the decades of study that I've been doing, the very largest set of questions that I come across are ones that I'm not in a position yet to answer. And they sort of, I imagine, this stack to the ceiling of open questions. And every so often, some piece of information comes along that allows me to pull a bunch of those together, and out pops another book. Planet X is something that could be out there. There are certainly intelligent people who think there's something out there. I wouldn't be surprised if it turns up in the next few years.
Next up, let's go to Glenn in Harlingen, Texas. Hey, Glenn, welcome to the program.
How are you doing, George?
Great, Glenn. Thank you.
Long time, no talk.
It's been a while, yeah.
I hope everything's fine with you and yours.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, great. Well, do you think your guest is ready for it?
Let's give it away. Fire.
Yep.
Okay. Well, as I understand it, when the kind, gentle, God-fearing Christian Europeans first settled New Zealand, you had and it's a very large place, the size of Great Britain, you had the majority of people, Stone Age Polynesians living in 6000 BC were happy to get a free ride into the 19th century and adopt a peaceful modern existence. The Maori, on the other hand, were were well on their way to being dregs of humanity like the Aztecs were. Murderous, warrior, slaver, ritualistic, cannibalistic scum who had the hatred and fear of all the other Polynesians on the island, and who gladly helped put a stop to their antics. And those, when they would not quit murdering and killing, were eliminated. There are no Maori in New Zealand. Now, since they were popularized in several British and American movies, the local inhabitants, the local Polynesians, have taken up a big tourist trade claiming that they're Maori. But the Maori were driven to extinction by the Polynesians who greedily exacted revenge for hundreds of years of murder and slavery.
All right. What do you think of that, Laird?
Well, I haven't come across any source that I see as credible that believes that. We have reports on the Maori. One of the major texts I used was published in 1920. So if the events you're talking about happened and the tourist trade you're talking about evolved, it had to have happened in as early as 1920, because there's a rich tradition that's reported by Elston Best. Now, from my perspective, this is all insider information, cosmologically speaking. This is not what he's reporting in his ethnology is not information that your average guy on the street had. This is information that would have had to have been carried with priests who had been initiated into the esoteric tradition and the ancient tradition. So it's real stuff. If we have pretenders out there claiming to be Maori who aren't, they've somehow hit on all of the right references and all the right words, ancient words to express them, and all of the right ancient symbols to use to reflect them, all the right ancient rituals, things that are in common with probably a half a dozen other traditions or more that I've studied. So somebody's doing a heck of a job if they've done what you say.
Let's go to Mary in New Jersey now. Mary, go ahead.
Hello, everybody. I have a question. The worldwide flood, everybody recorded it. Did your civilization record that in some type of writing or tradition?
All right. Was there any reference to the worldwide flood that occurred during the era of Noah?
Well, it's interesting that there's a Maori word that relates to the word Noah that means water or flood.
Really?
Maori tradition preserves almost word for word some passages from things like the Book of Exodus and so forth, in addition to some of the other references from other cultures that I talk about. It's very likely this tradition starts just after the end of the last ice age. It's very likely that when the ice age ended that there was flooding, that ice caps melted and there was flooding. That kind of an event makes it appear as if we had a change in the tilt of the axis of the Earth. That's the kind of thing that would cause that much melting globally. there are also cataclysmic events that some researchers say were responsible for the end of the abrupt end of the ice age. There were, apparently it's possible that the Earth was hit by comets. We see effects of that geologically.
Maybe Venus. You never know. Laird, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program again, and thanks for what you did on BeyondBelief.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burles, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.